You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at a different type of medicine, what my guests call slow medicine, an extended medical care. She refers to it akin to thinking of the body as a garden to be tended rather than a machine to be fixed. For over 20 years, Dr. Victoria Sweet was a physician at San Francisco's Laguna Honda Hospital, the last almshouse or charity hospital in the United States, a descendant of the Hotel Dieu that cared for the sick in the Middle Ages. It was a hospital for the poor, the homeless, and those whose fortune had fell on tough times, who needed extended but non-acute care. Her book, God's Hotel, A Doctor, A Hospital, and A Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine, traces her understanding of this human-paced medicine that was practiced at Laguna Honda and how that hospital has struggled to adapt to our contemporary views of medicine and hospitals' purposes. As an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, today she advocates for this slower pace of medicine to work in tandem with the technology and speed of our modern medicine system. She joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Sweet, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
Your book details your time at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco. It was, and I guess to an extent it still is, the last American almshouse. Now, that's a term most of us are not familiar with. What is an almshouse?
Well, an almshouse was actually, it's a very old term, and it's how we used to take care of the sick poor before we had health insurance. It's a very old system. It actually goes all the way back to the Middle Ages. And in fact, the title of my book, God's Hotel, actually comes from the French name for an almshouse. In French, it's called the Hotel Dieu. And some of your listeners may even have gone to the Hotel Dieu in Paris or heard of it. So almshouses were originally called God's hospitals or God's hotels, and they were big old places where anybody could come. And it used to be that almost every county in our country had an almshouse and also had an acute hospital. And the way it would work is that anybody could go. There was essentially no questions asked. Care was more or less free. Go to the acute hospital when you were acutely ill, and then if you needed more time to heal, if you had a chronic condition or you needed rehabilitation or they just didn't know what else to do, they sent you to the almshouse. And typically the almshouse was located on the outskirts of the city on a lot of land. And so those were kind of the three characteristics of an almshouse. And Laguna Honda was originally called the San Francisco Almshouse. And unlike every other county just about in the country, San Francisco is the only county that has not DC'd that system even to this day, so that there's a county hospital and then there's Laguna Honda.
Why did counties get rid of the almshouses? Was it economic? Was it?
Well, it's a really interesting story, but it was an odd couple between the left, who didn't like almshouses because they thought they were unjust, right? They weren't. Mm-hmm. It wasn't equal care. It may have been adequate, but it wasn't equal. And the right, who thought almshouses were expensive. So it was kind of an unwitting collusion between the two. And so both the left and the right was happy to close the almshouses all over the country. And then, of course, they started on the state mental institutions, and for the same reason. And now we have untreated mentally ill patients all over the place who have no place to go for exactly the same reason. So why San Francisco didn't? It has a lot to do with the nature of San Francisco as a city. And Laguna Honda, going back to the 1860s when it was called the San Francisco Almshouse, was always kind of a pet of the city. They took an incredible interest throughout history. There's a huge, the state is a huge volunteer organization. And when I looked at the history going back, you can find these wonderful articles in the San Francisco Chronicle from 1880s about visits to the almshouse. And it's just always been a very lovely part of the city.
Now, describe Laguna Honda when on your first visit.
Yeah.
You gave them a two-month trial that ended up being 20 years.
That's right.
Describe what Laguna Honda looked like, because it is big open wards.
That's right. They're called Nightingale wards. So people are familiar with them, really, from almost any old movie of the wards. The place itself, when I drove up and had never seen it, looks like a medieval monastery, deliberately, actually. It had a red-tiled roof and a bell tower and turrets. And the turrets were at the end of every one of these open wards. And they were called Nightingale wards because Florence Nightingale came up with these sort of mini hospitals. So each ward was kind of a mini hospital of 30 to 36 patients and beds lining the walls, with a solarium at the end with open windows. And it was called the solarium because they felt that getting fresh air and sunlight was important for you, even if you were bedridden. So these solarium at the end was set up so that every patient could be wheeled in and put in the sun and get fresh air and sun, even if they were bedbound. It's on 62 acres of land right in the middle of San Francisco. So you can imagine how that's looked at by the developers. And it had gardens. Still does. But I'll speak about it when I first came. So it had gardens that the patients would garden. It had a greenhouse. It had an aviary, which I loved, where we would watch chickens hatch from eggs. It had a little farm with rabbits and miniature black pigs that would visit the patients. It had a chapel, which was really more like a church, its own bakery. I mean, the place was fascinating and spacious and open.
It had a very interesting system. I mean, we're talking about doctors who were very much in consultation with one another, consultation with their patients, a nursing staff. Well, you describe a head nurse who, she saw every patient every day.
Mm-hmm.
She took her 3 hours to do her rounds, but she saw every single patient every day, and she gave instructions to her nursing staff. That sounds like fantasy land level of care compared to today.
Well, it's kind of ironic, though, because the way it worked, and it's one thing I liked about it, was doctors were on salary. So I always liked that myself, right? I get a salary, and then I sort of arrange things as best I can. And we had a certain number of patients to see. I was on the admitting ward because the hospital had 1,178 patients. And so patients were discharged from the hospital. Some of them died. So we had admissions every day, new patients. So I was one of the docs who admitted the new patient, and I had plenty of time to admit that new patient. And that was where I learned so much because the patients, as you can imagine, had made the rounds. Most of them came in on 15 or 20 medications, a lot of which they didn't need. And maybe some of them often never had the right diagnosis because nobody had ever sort of put two and two together because they never had time to put two and two together. And the nurses, particularly Miss Lester, the woman I call Miss Lester in the book, who was head of nursing, were remarkable because each ward had its own doc and each ward had its own nurse, its head nurse. So, you know, sort of the new buzzword these days is teams, but we kind of had a natural team. And the director of nursing was able to see all those patients, just eyeball them every day, and took her a few hours. But when you think of how many hours we spend on email to do less than the same thing, it was actually pretty efficient what she did, and we know that because there was one period of time when all the computers broke in the whole hospital. They broke everything. So email, all the labs, everything that they'd put on it, right? All the books that we put on the computer, everything was broken, except we still had our paper charts, fortunately. We were old-fashioned enough, we still had phones that plugged into the wall, and we still had clocks that plugged into the wall, and we still had face-to-face conversations. So what was interesting for me, the computers were down for 3 months, and I was fascinated. I had less work, considerably less work, when they were down than when they came back on again, time-wise.
Wow, because you're just simply caring for patients.
Yeah, and you know, what I found, honestly, was that it was such a hassle to get a lab. You had to, it was like when I was an intern years ago, right? I had to call the lab and ask for every report, that I found that I was getting fewer lab tests because I didn't really need them. I mean, I could just see the patient later on in the afternoon to see if they were getting sicker, getting better. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And if you needed to see somebody, you need to talk to somebody. Instead of emailing them, you just go track them down and talk face-to-face, which is way more efficient. You know, you get stuff done.
You know, when you hear doctors complain about the way medicine is today, a lot of times they lament that they still try to take time for that personal examination, but that is the amount of time that often gets stressed.
That's exactly right.
And, you know, as good conscientious doctors, they still try to do complete examinations.
Yeah.
But your book, in the anecdotes that you relate, it's just many times when people would come to Laguna Honda, they'd been through the county hospital, and just because of the sheer stress of time and the fact that acute beds were acutely needed, things got overlooked, and it was just a matter, not even, you know, maybe a simple x-ray would tell you, and your examination gave you a lot of answers that seemed to have been missing before.
It's the examination of all the things, by far, that if I could do one thing, it would be to look and touch the patient and take the blood pressure myself and take the pulse myself because there's just nothing like it, especially for an experienced physician. And yeah, it was, you know, it was just made all the difference. There's a story, I mean, there's one of the patients I don't even talk about in the book, but is an example of that, if you want an example.
Mm-hmm.
He came over and he was been sort of failing. He was like this 50-year-old guy, you know, sort of ex-World War II veteran type, smoker, and maybe drank too much. And he'd just been failing. He'd had every test known to man. Nobody could figure out why. So they sent him over to Laguna Honda because they didn't know what else to do. And when I go and I start my exam for the guy, I always, part of the really thorough exam is to feel somebody's scalp,
mm-hmm.
okay, actually feel their head. So that, I started with that, and he had lumps all over his scalp. Turned out he had metastatic esophageal cancer that was the cause of all of his symptoms that had metastasized to his scalp. So we got the diagnosis just by biopsying one of the masses in his scalp.
Oh, my gosh. And okay. it had moved from his esophagus to his
yeah,
scalp.
Yeah, it'll do that, right? Because cancers do metastasize, and sometimes they do metastasize to the skin. He's not the only person I had like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a perfect example. All I had to do is, as soon as I touched the man's head, all those tests that they had done over at the county hospital, that's the one thing they never did do. And, of course, nobody ever takes the time to sort of stand back and look at the patient and put things all together because they don't have the time. They're running around like, you know, chickens with their head cut off.
So you're looking at the color of the skin and his pallor and
everything.
Their whole
demeanor, their sense of things, you know, how bright-eyed are they? I had patients who had a diagnosis of, you know, severe dementia who they weren't demented. They were mute because maybe they had a stroke, but you could just tell by looking at them they weren't actually demented. They were present.
I remember one story that you relate in the book. It's about a man who came in with a swollen tongue.
Yeah, that was an amazing case.
You know, you said you thought it might have something to do with a vena cava. It turns out he had an amazing amount of fluid on his heart.
Yes.
But one of the things you said, this sort of gave me a great signal, was I had to take the blood pressure myself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And at the very tightest part of the cuff, you're listening for a heartbeat. And it gives you some sort of signal of what's going on. And I was thinking, when's the last time I had a doctor take my blood pressure?
Yeah.
You know, and this is this idea of slow medicine that you talk about. Explain slow medicine, if you will.
Well, slow medicine was how I finally put together what I'd been learning at Laguna Honda. After about 10 years, I really stepped back, and it had been one particular patient who had just sort of pulled it all together for me, a patient who came in because she was, at least in theory, demented, you know, an elderly demented patient with diabetes and psychosis and Alzheimer's, and she'd been living at home. She'd fallen and broken her hip 6 months before. They'd fixed her hip. They'd sent her home, but she never was able to manage to walk, so they sent her to Laguna Honda. Well, it turned out what was really going on is she had a dislocated hip that nobody had kind of realized, and once that was put back into place, her pain went away. I could take her off the pain medicine she'd been getting for her dislocated hip that nobody knew about. Once her pain medicines were gone, she brightened up. She didn't have dementia. I took her off her dementia medicine. She brightened up even more. Her diagnosis of diabetes turned out to be kind of an overdiagnosis. I took her off the insulin, and she walked out of the hospital and went back home. And when I was watching her walk out of the hospital and get in the taxi cab, and I was thinking about this whole push towards efficiency, doctors, you know, doing this and doing that, and everything they make us do these days, I added up how much what I thought of at that moment as our slow medicine. Slow because the essence of it was is that I was able to examine her carefully, and I was able to slowly get a sense of who she was, right? I didn't take her off all her medicines right away and throw out. I did one little thing, and then I'd reassess her, and then I did another little thing. So it took us 6 months between the time she got there to the time she got discharged. So slow, right? But it was efficient, because if you added up how much money ended up being saved because she ended up going home and not needing care in a place like Laguna Honda, it was hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I thought about it as slow medicine as opposed to fast medicine, just like there's slow food as opposed to fast food, that kind of analogy. So it's slow in the sense of the way slow food is slow, and that process is a lot of it. It's taking your time. It's doing things well. Fast medicine works great. I use it all the time. Fast medicine, if you have an appendicitis, I don't do slow medicine if you're rich. I wouldn't, all right? Send you, get your appendectomy. Well, after your appendectomy, that's when you don't need fast medicine. You need slow medicine. You need time to heal. You need time for somebody to fuss with you, to gradually take you off some of the medicines you got put on when you were in the hospital getting your appendectomy, like that. So I think of slow medicine as the doctor having enough time to do a good job, which means all the things we've been talking about, and the patient having enough time to heal. And my observation is that even though that looks like it's inefficient from a healthcare economist point of view, it's actually efficient, which means it's actually cost-effective for doctors to have enough time to do a good job, which seems like it's just common sense, but what can I say?
Yeah, no, but when you say cost-effective, you mean in the long term as opposed to the short term, which I think so many economists, healthcare economists, are looking at the cost for the hospital, not for the overall cost of the patient healthcare.
Well, I don't know what they're looking at. I mean, when I look at, you know, the graphs that the CBO puts out, and you look at all the stuff that they've done in the last 20 years, right, that they've tried, and they're still trying. There was HMOs, and now there's ACOs, which are kind of the same thing, and they're having the medical homes and DRGs, right, diagnostic related groups, and all these ideas that economists have, and yet healthcare costs keep rising every year. And when I looked, for instance, at Laguna Honda, what I saw, because I knew Laguna Honda well, I actually made a chart, and I could see that, you know, no matter what they did, we cut the number of patients we saw down by a third. We cut the number of doctors down by a third. We cut the number of nurses down by a third. But our budget kept rising every year. And why? Because even though we cut all the staff by a third that took care of patients, the administrators, the number of administrators, rose every year.
Mm.
And when I asked myself, well, what did all these administrators do? What I noticed is the one thing we had more of at Laguna Honda when I left and when I arrived there were forms.
Paperwork.
When I got there, there were two single-page forms in the chart. When I left, I randomly opened a chart the day I left and counted. And there were 43 forms, Rich.
Wow.
And that's nothing to compare to what we're going to have when the ACA comes on board. I've read the darn thing and all 922 single-spaced pages of it. And it is makes the hair on my back of my neck stand up.
Mm.
Because it's not that it's in bad faith, but it's just a nightmare of new regulations and forms and divisions and departments, and it's going to be incredibly costly. And we are not going to have a healthcare budget that's spent for taking care of patients.
My guest today is Victoria Sweet. She's the Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. She served 20 years at Laguna Honda Hospital, the last almshouse in the United States, and there's precious few in the world, I think. Her book is titled God's Hospital, A Doctor, A Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine. And it's a recounting of her 20 years of, and you actually have done some comparative work overseas, looking at other systems.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the ACA, and the history of Laguna Honda is also sort of very short. I mean, you started practicing there really at the time when medical costs really seemed to begin to skyrocketing.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And I'm just wondering, if we rolled back some of this regulation,
mm-hmm.
is it possible to run a hospital with the level of personal care that you describe mm-hmm. in the book, the staffing needed to provide that mm-hmm. personal care, with all this new technology and still be financially viable?
I think that's a really fair question, and I could say three things about it. I think the fairest thing to say is, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Why don't we try?
We haven't done it yet.
You know, why don't we? This is what I really hope comes out of the book, okay, other than, you know, fame and fortune, obviously. But really what I hope comes out of the book is an opportunity to take a piece of a hospital someplace and do it this way. Let's have an experiment. There's experiments all the time. You know, why not take a ward in a hospital, a unit, whatever they call it, and have it be, I call it in my book, the eco-medicine ward or the slow medicine ward, where doctors, as an experiment, are given all the time they need, all the time they want to take care of a patient, and nurses, and we see how well people do over a six-month period of time or a year or 2 years. So that's what I'm hoping comes out of it. Let's experiment. Let's see. Especially for patients, as I said, in the sort of intermediate point of their care. I think modern medicine does a really fantastic job, whether it's a lot of money or not. When you're really sick, it's amazing what modern medicine does. But after you come out of that acute period is when we drop the ball.
Well, we all have stories of people who have had what used to be considered a major surgery, and they're going home in 24 mm-hmm. hours, 48 mm-hmm. hours. You're talking
yeah.
about the appendectomy earlier.
Yeah.
I mean, that might be an overnight stay, tops, or maybe a couple
that.
Of days.
Right, right.
And in the old days, it was a week.
At least. So those kinds of advances are superb. But where we're dropping the ball, I think, is after that period of time. The patient gets his, you know, medicines and is supposed to inject himself with heparin and, you know, go home and there's nothing there. Or patients who really need a lot more care, who need the kind of care that Laguna Honda did, who need months of recovery.
Yeah,
or we have no place to put those patients or to do a good job with that.
And of course, you've probably seen the videos of hospitals, the public care hospitals. They've stabilized the patient. The patient has nowhere to go.
Oh, yeah.
But they take a van and drop them off. Yeah.
That was an absolute shocking video.
Yeah. So this idea of an eco-medicine or the slow medicine clinic, you mentioned the patient that took 6 months to really work on it.
Right.
Is that feasible in this day and age, you think?
Well, what's the opposite? So the opposite was that...
Bad outcome, really. That's what it ends up
being. Well, bad outcome, yeah. I mean, you know, I say, Rich, I say, yeah, only death is cost efficient.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, if she died really quickly, that might work well on the, you know, overall accounting, but really, in fact, in any other place, she would have lingered for years.
Into hospital, out of hospital, into hospital, out of hospital.
Or at Laguna, I mean, at a rehab center, or a nursing home, she would have, you know, average is about 6 years. So if you look at the cost of that, you have to figure it's, what, $90,000, $100,000 easily a year in a nursing home. Now, that's 6 years, $600,000, and then she would have died. So at Laguna Honda, it was cost, that care she got cost, if we're just doing dollars and cents, about $60,000 in that 6 months.
Mm.
So that $60,000 is a lot of money, except if you compare it to $600,000. When she actually went home, ran her own house, and in her particular case, she had a developmentally delayed daughter who was in her 40s, and she continued to take care of her daughter.
Mm.
We were looking at placing that daughter for another $50,000 a year. So I don't think every single person needs it, but to have no longer, it's like a missing piece. What's happened in my life as a physician is there's now a significant, it's a missing piece. Now, let me give you one, I know we're sort of short of time, but I thought about it quite a bit when I realized that when I was a medical student, we would often admit patients for what was called a workup. So somebody would come in and they had a GI bleed. So that meant they're having bleeding in their intestinal tract. We don't know where it's from. So we would admit them for that. And in 2 days, 3 days max, we would have had the gastroenterologist would have scoped them bottom and top. We would have done all the tests. We would have the diagnosis. We would have the treatment, and they get discharged. At some point, we stopped being able to admit a patient for a workup. So now what happens is the patient gets like all these, you know, gets 17 different things. They're supposed to go to the lab and get their blood drawn, and then 2 weeks from then, they go to the gastroenterologist. And 3 weeks later, it takes 6 weeks or 2 months, incredibly stressful for the patient, crazy for the doc, because you never know what's going to happen with this GI bleed, let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, it's not saving any money. And we used to be able to do that. And that is a piece they shut down in the trying to save money. Like, why should a patient be admitted for a workup? They could do it on the outside. Well, that may be so on paper, but in practice, we need awards like that. And in Switzerland, for instance, when I was overseas and I spent that year in Switzerland, they still did that. They had an award like that where you could, a unit, that you could admit a patient, if you were the doc, for a workup, an expeditious workup.
And get it all taken care of.
Get it all taken care of. Get everything.
Hours. Yeah.
Everything taken care of. And not to have that, I think, is a huge stress on the system. But that's one example of where I think it would be very cost effective to do. And as you said, all the patients who have no place to go because there's no alms equivalent of an almshouse, big old place that anybody can get admitted to somewhere in your city that has adequate care. I've thought a lot about this whole question of equal. Like, if you listen to the left, there's a lot of stress on equal care, but you know the thing is you can have equally bad care.
or you know, you may have equal care in theory, but in practice it means if you have insurance, you get the extra day in hospital to recuperate, and if you don't, you go out earlier.
Well, I mean, what about adequate care? That to me is my modest goal. I want a patient to get care that's at least good enough. I don't care whether it's equal to somebody else's. It just needs to be good enough. And I think that what happened with the almshouses, they weren't equal. And now we're partly in a bind.
The name of the book is God's Hospital, A Doctor, A Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine. Victoria Sweet is my guest today. And over the course of Laguna Honda, there were a lot of changes. There was a Department of Justice probe which didn't like the idea that 36 patients are on a ward. They looked at a lot of different things, and now Laguna Honda is a pretty different place in many regards. Hopefully that spirit that you were talking about is still there, but it sounds like a very different place.
It is a very different place. It's beautiful. I mean, so San Francisco, instead of closing their almshouse under all this pressure, there was a huge bond. They spent a lot of money. They built a state-of-the-art facility. It's really beautiful. And we take care of a third fewer patients, actually. And it's very modern. It's downsides, I think. And I haven't practiced there. My sense of visiting and talking to people is that because the patients are the same and the patients in a lot of ways were what made it so special, that there's a lot of that specialness left there. And I think the staff does their absolute best to maintain that same quality of kindness and care. But they're doing it, it's like they're doing it against the grain of the regulations that are just tying us all up. Mm. So I think it's still working, but kind of in spite of the physical place and in spite of the whole tenor of things these days, rather than going with it.
You know, you mentioned the Nightingale wards, and I think the Department of Justice probe over the years at the hospital looked at that idea as being antiquated. Mm-hmm. And you said there are benefits, though, and most patients really don't want to go into a big open ward. Mm-hmm. But you said there are benefits because if you don't have a support system, mm-hmm. you don't have friends coming to see you, that's the way to make friends and to sort of have that human contact that in many cases you're often cut off from in the hospital.
That's exactly right, and Nightingale actually knew that when she made them, because she considered having private rooms, even back in the 1860s when she wrote her book called Notes on Hospitals. I think we should draw a distinction between being acutely ill, right, living in your home, you get sick, you go to an acute hospital. I think having a private room makes sense in that case. Where private rooms do not make sense is in a place like Laguna Honda, when you're chronically ill, when you're stuck in a hospital for weeks or months, unable to get yourself out, and if at best your family visits maybe a little bit, you can be so lonely in a private room. And when I talk to the patients at Laguna Honda now who are in private rooms, which the Department of Justice worked very hard to get them, they're much lonelier. They're just, in practice, much lonelier. So an open ward has a lot of advantages for patients. It also has advantages for the nurses, because one of the reasons that Nightingale came up with this idea is she called one head nurse, one ward. Because a head nurse, the head nurse who was in charge of her ward, her 36-bed ward, could see all the patients at once. And it was a very efficient way, actually, of taking care of patients. These days, those same 36 patients are in individual rooms. And the only way for the head nurse to keep an eye on them is to walk in and out of every room all day long. Well, you can imagine what that's like. Or to have cameras on patients, which I think is ironic because the idea was that patients would have more privacy in the private rooms. But in fact, what would you have more? And I'll just say from a golden rule point of view, I've asked myself, what would I prefer? And I can tell you I would much prefer being on an open ward if I was chronically ill. Much more interesting.
Well, it's a fascinating look at a way of medicine that was... Well, it was practiced through the first half of the 20th century, maybe even into the second half of the 20th century, mm-hmm. and now it's quickly disappearing.
Yeah.
The name of the book is God's Hotel. Dr. Sweet, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Dr. Victoria Sweet is an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California at San Francisco and the author of God's Hospital, A Doctor, A Hospital, and A Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine. It's published by Riverhead Books. She has been a practicing physician at the Laguna Honda Hospital for over 20 years. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.